Justice and Drew, along with Sam here on Twin Cities News Talk. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. About to talk to our D.C. correspondent, Andrew Langer, brought to you by Randy's Electric.
Good morning, Andrew. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, gentlemen, and good lady.
Good morning.
Piece out of Fox News. We'll start here. We got a number of different things we want to talk to you about. But CNN slammed for glowing puff piece about Kim Jong-un's sister at Olympics. In the article published Saturday afternoon, it said this: if a diplomatic dance were at an event at the Winter Olympics, then Kim Jong-un's younger sister would be favored to win gold with a smile, a handshake, and a warm message in South Korea's presidential guest book. Look, how much, my opinion is this whole thing started with Pence. Like, the media can't stand Pence so much that the contrast between Pence and Kim Jong-un's sister was too much to resist. So they had to go and lavish praises on this individual who's part of a horrible, murderous regime.
Yeah, just like the head of propaganda.
Keep in mind, the other part of this is that they are trying to suggest that this new dawn of relations between North Korea and South Korea is somehow going to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea, which is idiotic, seeing as how we're responsible for a massive part of their GDP. But yeah, I mean, this is the reality. And the other part of this, of course, is that the warm, cozy relations between North and South Korea are in no small measure due to the fact that Donald Trump was working so hard to anger and annoy both sides that it brought them together to sort of face a common, I wouldn't say enemy, but, you know, to sort of look with disdain about this, you know, at this doofus in Washington. And that's not, you know, my opinion. That's what I'm saying is their opinion of it is.
Right. Yeah. The analysis that I heard that I thought was kind of ridiculous. I mean, maybe there's something to it, is, you know, with Trump sort of taking an America first stance and the rhetoric being of, you know, we have to protect America, we have to protect Americans, the South Koreans might feel like they've been devalued in the eyes of the administration, and that, you know, the administration would be willing to sacrifice South Koreans in order to protect Americans. I mean, I don't buy that, but that's sort of been the analysis that a lot of people have taken. Do you give that any weight?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the reality is that what happened is that the tensions between these two guys, and then by that I mean Kim and Trump, you know, were so heightened that and I think this is by design. I'm more and more thinking that a lot of this is by design. That, you know, Trump ratchets up the rhetoric. The South Korean president, his name's now escaping me, you know, the South Korean government becomes sufficiently alarmed that they, you know, turn around and take a greater ownership stake in their own future. I mean, this is exactly what Trump campaigned on, this idea of we are not supposed to be the protectors of the world's policemen. We want South Korea, we want Japan, we want these other nations to take a greater interest in their own futures. And if it means sort of ramping things up so that, you know, hey, if you go, tell them, hey, if you go down this road with us, this is how we're going to do things. So maybe you ought to take a greater role in this. And that's what I think has happened here. And it is fascinating to watch.
Well, and again, it further lends to the lack of credibility from outlets like CNN when they go the route of completely dismissing the background of where Kim Jong-un's sister is coming from to go and lavish this type of praise upon her. And they do themselves no favors by doing that.
You know, when they try to have Kim Fields from Facts of Life, then I'll be happy.
Why does CNN? I mean, CNN has to know that this was a terrible headline, and they certainly know that they've been dragged through the mud for 2 days now regarding it. Yet it's still out there and it's still up, and I haven't seen really any reaction or response from CNN to the criticism. Do they just not care?
CNN is turning around and focusing all of their attention on the Porter story and the Me Too movement and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so they're just going to kind of let this go in the same way, I think, that the, you know, NBC had that great gaffe during the opening ceremonies. About the South Koreans and Japan. The NBC apologized, but I think, you know, there are many who just want to sort of see these kinds of things sort of go away.
Switching gears a bit, let's talk a little bit about the budget deal, and rightfully so, a lot of conservatives upset, you know, Rand Paul being the lone sort of holdout that, you know, made his views on this be known. But I'm seeing, and appropriately so, a lot of individuals who support President Donald Trump who are looking at this deal and talking about this is not what the GOP should be doing. What are your thoughts? Is it going to be damaging?
Well, I get it. I mean, I guess there's an idea going around that it's very hard to drain the swamp if you are putting more money into the swamp. And I understand that. I take a slightly different view because, yes, I get concerned when we spend more money, and we need to take a long, hard look at entitlement reform. But on the other hand, there was so much more to be gained by getting this deal because it essentially takes the monetary cudgel off the table in terms of the both the infrastructure and, more importantly, the immigration debate. Right now, Donald Trump can go ahead and say, hey, if you don't get me a deal on immigration, I am going to end the Dreamer program permanently. And then where will you be?
I do question if depending on what Trump does with DACA, if we begin to see pushback if he starts going more of the bipartisan route. Because my concern comes down to the fact that, you know, we talk about bipartisanship, we're talking about reaching across the aisle, but if you do that, you're going to end up ticking off your base. And the problem that I have is that when you can say, well, we'll use it as an argument, we'll be better than the Democrats, look at what we do when we're bipartisan, look at how we're all kumbaya, but then when the Democrats get back in power, they are not going to do that. Right. They will not be
not
reaching across the aisle.
Credit.
No.
I agree with that sentiment, that second sentiment, wholeheartedly. To me, it is, part of this is about making sure that nothing distracts going into the 2018 midterms from the good news about the economy. And so if you can take the immigration fight off the table, this is one particular view of the politics of the situation. Then you're going down this road. But I will say this much, guys, right? You push back. This is what these kinds of compromises and political negotiations, this is what so many Americans have been clamoring for. And so, yeah, it's going to, there are decisions that are going to be made that are going to upset people in the base. But when push comes to shove, right, in 2020, are they going to vote for Elizabeth Warren? Or are they going to vote for Donald Trump? Right. With the confounding variable being if somebody like a Mike Lee challenges Donald Trump from the right.
Switching gears again, let's go here.
Sure.
Democrats' very political memo was weaponized so they could play the transparency blame game. That's a headline out of the Washington Examiner. Now, there was a lot of Trump was taking a lot of hits because he released the GOP memo, but he would not. He blocked the Democrat one. But the talk has been that they loaded it with a bunch of stuff that they knew was going to be classified, that they would not allow it to be released. And Trump has come back around the backside and said, "Hey, look, if you take those things out, I'll release the memo." Is this whole thing dying down just across the board? I mean, is the whole issue of the memos and FISA, is it slowly drifting from the headlines and therefore out of the minds of the public consciousness?
Well, it's out for the time being, but not forgotten. I mean, when you have these other issues sort of taking precedence over it, between the Olympics and Korea and the president's budget coming out today and the infrastructure plan coming out today, all of those things are going to take precedence. But I fully believe the memo is going to be back in square one. You know, remember, these stories come in waves, and we have the particular scandal du jour of the week. So once we get past the Porter situation, and whether or not the Democrats are able to get John Kelly's scalp, which I don't think they will, but they're trying, then we move back to, you know, these other important issues. And I urge everybody to go out and read Andrew McCarthy's great piece in the National Review on Saturday about how big this scandal is, why these memos, and why there's a Grassley memo out there that if you haven't read it, you got to take a look at.
Do you buy into the notion that the Democrats put this information in the memo on purpose Trump to not release it?
This was their modus operandi. They wanted to be able to say that the White House forced them to edit the memo. You've got this complete jerk, Eric Swalwell, congressman from California, who's just a smarmy guy that they have on because Adam Schiff's been such a disaster on CNN, you know, talking about how, oh, well, ours had to be War and Peace, which incidentally isn't a very good book, but ours had to be War and Peace because the Republicans' memo was just a nursery rhyme. I mean, you know, listen, this is exactly what they were going to do. They will continue to push back on this. But the facts that are in this memo, the Republican memo, are not in dispute. I mean, you know, we now have, and now with the text that came out last week, you know, we now have the White House and John Brennan at the CIA directly involved in this situation, and this is really disturbing stuff.
You know, I can't help it. I'm going to be somewhat cynical here, but I'll open it up and get your guys' thoughts on this, right? How okay would you be if the FISA issue and the memo in the court slowly drifted from the media, but with that, so did the Russia collusion narrative against Donald Trump? Because I do think there's a possibility that one is attached to the other one. And if the GOP were to calm down and the Democrats don't want to continue to make an issue of it because they know what a big deal it is, then it has the potential to take down that Russia collusion narrative. And is that trade-off worth it? Or is the bigger picture of the FISA court and accountability and what they're doing too important?
Well, listen, I think this is so much bigger than the FISA court, John. No, I would not want to let it go because if it's demonstrated that Barack Obama was intimately involved in a use of our intelligence services and our criminal justice services to go after the opponent in the 2016 presidential elections, that's just too big for any of us to ignore. That is massive, and so I wouldn't. And frankly, even short of that, you know, getting further evidence and proof that people at the FBI and DOJ were affirmatively in the tank for going after Donald Trump, I can't ignore that. We just can't sit for that. That takes consequences. Barack Obama, he's not in a position to resign, but he is in a position to go in front of a judge and have to explain himself.
Talking with our D.C. correspondent, as we do every Monday, Andrew Langer, powered by Randy's Electric.
Yeah, that's the big thing for me. I want accountability, because if there's no accountability, then there's no way anybody could have confidence that it won't happen again. And that it won't be worse next time. And they won't have learned.
I mean, there was zero accountability in terms of the IRS Tea Party scandal. And every time you don't hold these people accountable, it lets the left off the hook. And they can come back and say, well, nobody ever went to jail in the IRS scandal.
If there's no accountability, they're just going to do it better next time.
Nobody's been indicted at the FBI. It's like, okay, you know something? I would like some accountability so I can push back against that narrative.
Well, and there's no, they're just going to do it better next time. If there's no accountability, though, they will have learned from their mistakes, and they will cover their tracks even better next time. We've got a call I want to take here while we got you on, Andrew Langer. Darren in Savage, go ahead.
Hey, thanks, guys, for having me on. Hey, I'm done with compromise, because every time I hear the word compromise, all it means is that if the conservatives lose, the Democrats win. And I'm tired of that. I want us to actually stand firm and start fighting for our values and our principles.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you, Darren. I was saying on the show on Friday, I'm kind of tired of this reaching across the aisle bipartisan nonsense. I want overwhelming majorities.
But I've been wrong on the record as saying you cannot reconcile liberty with anti-liberty. But the problem, of course, is, guys, that until we get a supermajority of free market limited government types, it's going to be obstruction, which I'm fine with, right? I'm fine with Congress doing nothing. Or we're going to get these situations in which compromises are going to happen. So, you know, yeah, I get that. But until we start electing more, you know, this is our lot.
Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty and host of the LangerCast, instituteforliberty.org, again, powered by Randy's Electric. As always, thank you so much for the time this morning. Sir, greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you next Monday.
Take care.
I don't mind. I mean, I'd like to see compromise if it were equally shared. I mean, the way that politics should work, you know, because you do have two dominant opposing parties, there should be the ability, whoever, regardless of who's in power, to have a reaching across the aisle. But the unfortunate byproduct of that is when the other party is in power, that being the Democrats, that doesn't ever go that way. And so you end up compromising too much. And for me, it comes down to a question of, do you want the ability to say when they are in power, when they don't compromise, that, hey, we did, do you want to be able to use it as an argument? You know, is that worth it? Right?
No.
It just makes you feel good.
Yeah,
I did the right thing, you know, but no, I'm kind of with you and kind of with Darren, you know, and it's tough. It's very, very tough.
Yeah, we've got to start moving in a more libertarian, liberty-minded, free market-minded, small government-minded direction. We can't. The current path is unsustainable. And if compromise is just going to mean we go down the current path at a bit of a slower pace, that has no value to me.
Coming up on Justice and Drew, we will get to this Washington Examiner article about DACA. It seems like the Washington Examiner gets it about the problem with DACA and the way the media spin has been. Plus, we'll dive into some local issues, local elections, five reasons why Rick Nolan's announcement is a big deal. Also, Tim Pawlenty, you know, how big are the vulnerabilities where if he were to decide to go in and run for Minnesota governor?
Justice and
News Talk AM 1130, hour two of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. 651-989-5855 is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. We're going to be joined by Paul Allen in just about an hour from now. I want to get his thoughts on the Vikings' new offensive coordinator.
Got an article here. If I could heart a particular article this morning, it would be this one out of the Washington Examiner. The national media are incapable of talking about the so-called dreamers, illegal immigrants brought to the U.S. as minors, without portraying them as victims of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
They're victims of circumstances brought on by their own parents and nothing else. And I was so happy to see, and there's a lot of different facets to the article, and they get into a lot of different issues, but just on its face, that particular sentence, victims of circumstances brought on by their own parents and nothing else. When you roll back all the way back to the very, very beginning of how these circumstances end up bringing themselves about, I've always held the opinion that these are, in the simplest form, family matters. These are issues between the kids that grew up here in the United States to parents who were here illegally, whose parents made the choice to put them in that situation. So ultimately, it's the parents' fault that this happened. I don't begrudge individuals who took advantage of DACA because of what their parents did in putting them into this situation.
Yeah.
Most rational people would, but these are family issues.
And I feel bad for these people that were brought here as children, don't have any sort of support structure, life, connection to the place that their parents brought them here from. The only home they've ever known is the United States. I feel bad for them that their status is in limbo. But this is not the makings of the Trump administration. They did not do this. They did not put them in this situation. Trump did the right thing when he said, we're going to end this DACA program.
Right.
Because if there's ever going to be any sort of rectification for these people, some permanent fix to their status, it has to be done through Congress. Laws have to be passed in order to do this. You can't just have this sort of continuing, essentially unconstitutional presidential action that Obama started. That's not, you know, do you really want your status to be in limbo and have these deadlines keep coming and coming and coming in perpetuity? No, of course not. You want a permanent fix, and President Trump did the right thing by putting the pressure on Congress to come up with something. If Congress can't do that, that's on Congress. That's not on the Trump administration.
And the part of this that gets lost in all the discussion and never gets talked about is nobody ever talks about what was kind of like when you talk about healthcare and prior to when they put Obamacare in place, right? Nobody ever talks about what it was like prior to that. Be that as it may, nobody wants to have a discussion or mention how things were prior to DACA getting enacted, because the reality is, and I saw it firsthand, the reality is you already had a spoken DACA program, not written down, but spoken. You already had U.S. Customs and Border Protection. You already had Border Patrol. You already had school systems that already had their own protections in place for these individuals. The people that were getting in trouble and getting deported, by and large, were the now potential DACA recipients, but those that were going and breaking the law. Those are the people prior to DACA getting in place that were being held accountable and deported. So that is to say that there is a line of thinking and reasoning that if you did get rid of DACA, things would not drastically change, because they already were using discretion when it came to these issues, when law enforcement was coming in contact with these people. And the article goes on to say, for the sake of not buying into the nonsense, we'll refer to them as DACA people. DACA being the Obama era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. During his State of the Union address this month, Trump justified his position on DACA: my duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too. Liberal Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank wrote that the line was an attempt by Trump to make off with the dreamer label, and that it implied that DACA people are not American.
Well, they're not.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Sounds like, you know, you're being mean when you say it, but they're not. They're from other countries. It's
yeah.
Not complicated.
Right.
Being American. It's not an insult.
Right. The problem is we associate, you know, America with like a feeling.
Right.
It's an actual thing.
People place a value on that word, and yeah, I understand
yeah.
that. It makes sense, sure, but.
But it's an actual thing.
But it's also a description. It's also an adjective that has a meaning and a definition.
Right, the article lays it out. They're literally not American citizens, right? So you can be yeah. you can be America all you want in your heart, but if you're going to put down an official classification, you're really kind of not.
Maybe they identify as American.
They're
trans-American.
The Huffington Post on Thursday began a news article about DACA with an anecdote about one recipient who left her family and her South Carolina hometown and boarded a flight to Washington, D.C. to fight for her right to remain in the United States. To which the article goes on to say, what right to remain in the United States? If that right existed, we wouldn't be talking about deporting them.
Yeah. If you're not a citizen, you know, you don't have that right. It's not written down anywhere. It's not bestowed upon you by any document or being.
Yeah, and I can't decide whether or not, like, I want the GOP to be like this, because there's a part of me that does and a part of me that doesn't. But all of this really does speak to how good they're such pros at labeling and crafting narratives. Because when you do boil it down to its essence, right, actual law, everything in here is absolutely correct. However, that's not the world we live in. The world we live in is one where America, you know, is a feeling. It is one where an individual will board a flight to Washington, a person who's here illegally, to say, I'm fighting for my right to stay, when the law says you have no right to stay.
You don't.
They're so good at it. They're such pros at the propaganda. I wish we were better, but I don't.
The article goes on. On Wednesday, a hilarious CNN headline declared that these dreamers will leave the U.S. if a DACA deal isn't reached. Well, yeah, but that's not really a choice that the DACA people get to make.
Right.
Because they're going to be deported because they don't have the status to be here legally. And the bottom line is, and it's it I it it it. it brings me some degree of comfort to see more and more people coming to this realization about the Democrats. That it is more politically valuable for the Democrats to have these DACA people status remain in perpetual limbo than it is to actually work with Republicans to come up with a solution. Republicans have offered Democrats solution after solution, fix after fix after fix. All they have to do is agree to some border security, is agree to some wall funding. And that to them is unsustainable. They cannot come to terms with that. They cannot agree to just throw some money at President Trump's wall and permanently fix the status of these DACA recipients. So what does that tell you? That tells you that they care more about not giving Trump that win on border security than they do about the status of these dreamers.
Yeah, Trump's even increased like the number of individuals who would end up being protected if they went through and got a deal done. And look, and that's why they never did anything when they were in power, right? And look, we were saying that at the time. At the time, we were saying that because when they had, and it was, and you go back and look at the headlines back when the Democrats had all the power in the world, and you'll find out that every time they went to go move on Dreamers, they added a whole bunch of nonsense to it, knowing full well that it would get shot down because of it, because they didn't want to have it happen.
651-989-5855. Got a few people want to chime in on this. We'll continue this conversation next on Justice and Drew.
Justice and Drew.
AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice and Drew, 651-989-5855. The last point, that's the phone number, by the way. The last point in this Washington Examiner article, the media's DACA scam isn't working. Trump doesn't need the DACA people for anything. Democrats absolutely have to have them to satisfy their left-wing voters. But even with the Democrats' unplayable hand, Trump's proposal still offers full citizenship for DACA people, and it covers three times as many as Democrats wanted in the first place. In return, Trump wants to fulfill campaign promises to eliminate illegal immigration and make the current system more selective on who enters the country. So that's the trade-off. The media can frame the debate as though Trump is doing something wrong, but everybody knows where this attempted scam is going.
Yeah.
Yeah, but to your point, though, of the what a monster, it makes me laugh because we see people, and this is just sort of anecdotal of the stuff that we see, but you see people on Twitter go and make comment about Trump, and the default is just, they just hate him.
Yeah.
They just hate him as a person.
And they prescribe the worst motivations to everything that is going on. I mean, they prescribe, you know, racism to the fact that he's offered DACA deals to the Democrats. He's the president. He gets to sort of do this, right? You know, he gets to say, look, I'm not going to sign anything unless it's got X, Y, and Z in it. And all he wants is border security. All he wants is border funding. All he wants is funding going towards his wall. That doesn't sound to me like it's that unreasonable a compromise to make if you're the Democrats. But the fact is, the Democrats don't want a solution to DACA. They want this to be an issue going into the midterms. They want this to be right. An electoral issue. They are willing to let the status of these recipients remain in limbo. They are willing to let them be deported if they think that will increase their chances of winning more seats in November. That's the bottom line.
You listen to enough commentary and especially stuff outside of politics, and you'll see, you know, the Trump narrative emerge, and just a little quips here and there of, you know, the world we live in now because of Trump, right? You just see it all over the place. I don't really want this to happen, but I feel like maybe it should happen. We need to get a group of like prominent Republicans, right? People who are well respected and known, together with a group of, if possible, prominent Democrats, and have a little intervention and go like, hey, look, take it from a group of individuals on our side of the aisle that spent 8 years of complaining about Obama. It just becomes a joke after a while. Thanks, Obama. People stop taking you seriously. You guys are quickly going to realize this on your side if you continue down. I want that to happen, but I don't really want it to happen. But it feels like we've seen this whole thing before. And guess what? It doesn't matter. It ultimately doesn't matter. To the average American citizen, your hatred of Donald Trump is only going to get you so far in elections. It's only going to craft the narrative so far, because the majority of people are just going to sit back and go, I'm tired of it. Can we talk about things of substance already? We know you don't like Trump. Get over, because they all said the same thing to us.
Yeah. And when again, we talked about this, you know, earlier, with the decisions that people that affect people as they get closer to election day and as they walk into the voting booths. You know, with the economy doing as good as it's been doing, sure, the stock market's been a little volatile last week, but overall, you know, it's been a great year for the stock market.
Yeah.
Overall, it's been a really good year for the economy. Workers are seeing more in their paychecks. They are getting bonuses. There are more jobs now than there were. Unemployment numbers have declined significantly. That trend continues, and it's just going to make those anti-Trump arguments even more hollow.
I thought Trump got rid of the stock market. Didn't he do it this morning? Didn't he unilaterally just eliminate it? Just lock the doors and shut it all down? No more stock market? He didn't do
I'm
that.
Tired of this stock market.
Right. It's too volatile.
Just get rid of it.
Just get rid of it altogether. All right. Out of the Pioneer Press, late in the day on Friday.
Surprising news on Friday.
Yeah, U.S. Representative Rick Nolan, Democrat from Northeast Minnesota, announced that he won't seek re-election.
The DFL went into a bit of a tailspin. I don't think a lot of people were expecting this.
Yeah, the press even says, make no mistake, Nolan's decision, which, as Drew just said, surprised many political observers, is a game changer, not just for his district, but potentially for the landscape of Minnesota politically. And they break down reasons why. We can go through some of this. Possible gain for Republicans, crazy campaign coming, mining politics. The question up front, Drew, I have for you is, in terms of spending,
yeah,
you've got both parties now, at least it seems like, are going to have a difficult task of, you know, prioritizing and appropriately dividing up where they go and spend the money, in some cases, the little money they have, and on which campaigns and which candidates now.
There's going to be probably an unprecedented amount of money coming into Minnesota from outside groups, from the national Republican to Democrat parties, and from political action committees. We had a governor's race. You know, we had two Senate races coming up in November. We already have some competitive districts. CD2 is somewhat competitive. 8th was going to be definitely competitive, and now even more so. The amount of money that's going to flow into this state for political advertising, political spending, campaign donations is going to be off the chart. It's going to be amazing.
Well, and you put on top of that the fact that, you know, using volatile again, but there's so much uncertainty right now. I mean, from day to day, the narratives change, the headlines change. Who knows when it comes time to actually go and vote? How voters are going to be viewing candidates in the wake of whatever is happening in Washington right now. I mean, it's impossible to use any past predictions or indicators to show just how these races are going to play out with any kind of certainty.
This is a huge opportunity for the GOP here in the state to have Nolan step down. It was already a close district. It was a tough district. It's a district that went for Trump in 2016. They voted for Trump and Nolan. So are the Democrats, is the DFL going to be able to find a candidate that can sort of toe that line of appealing to a generally conservative part of the state, and still, you know, be amenable to the DFL activists? I doubt it.
Right.
I seriously doubt it.
You wonder too, or at least I wonder what the messaging is going to be. Looking at it sort of from an optimistic standpoint, getting back to that uncertainty. Like, if you're a candidate, you're almost the only game, if you're going to game it, right? The only play you have is to just be as genuine and authentic as possible, because there's no way you can put your political finger to the wind, lick it, and find out which way it's blowing. So you're really just going to have to go on what it is that you know and who you truly are. And I hope that it ends up being sort of with all these seats, I hope it ends up being a much better election cycle than what we've seen in the past, because people are going to have to be more honest and genuine. They can't default to so many talking points.
Yeah. It's interesting. Pete Stauber's been the leading Republican candidate candidate for the seat. He is he's in favor of the mining plans that are polarizing the area up there. Nolan has been friendly to the mining plans as well. He was facing a primary challenge from Leah Pfeiffer, a political newcomer who opposes both mines. And in the Pioneer Press, it talks about how in the DFL precinct caucuses, Rebecca Otto won the straw poll for governor in the 8th. She's positioned herself as the most strident environmentalist and opponent to the mining plans. And that was the only congressional district that Walz did not win. Tim Walz has been receptive to the mining plans. So it indicates that the DFL base, just the DFL base there, is very, very much against the mining plans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, Nolan was facing a primary challenge. So it's very likely that, if it does end up being Leah Pfeiffer or whomever, is the nominee for CD8 up there, is going to be anti-mining, the DFL base up there, but that's not indicative of the area as a whole.
Right.
My gut and it appears to me that the area as a whole is much more receptive to the mining plans. It's just the DFL base, the DFL activists, the ones that show up to caucus and participate in these straw polls.
Well, and to what you were saying, in the article, it talks about large numbers of voters in the 8th, and you mentioned it a moment ago, split their tickets in 2016 voting for Trump. And Nolan, what does this mean this year? Will Trump energize Democrats? Has the district swung further right, including traditionally left-wing unions? Is there notable dissatisfaction among Trump supporters? Who will show up at the polls? On that first one, will Trump energize Democrats? That's the one that always makes me laugh, because people think that there's an energy attached to the negativity,
right?
And there usually isn't. I mean, we saw that with the presidential election. There was just, people are going to go and vote out against Trump. No. Yeah. Now, granted, everybody did hate Hillary, but, that didn't happen. That didn't materialize.
Yeah, that negative energy more often than not leads to people just not showing up.
Right. Yeah. I'll just stay home.
Dave Santiago, good morning.
Good morning. One of the things that everyone forgets about is when they talk about the grassroots, the people on the right who are the grassroots, workers, the volunteers who spend hours and hours and days. And, it's unbelievable how much time volunteers spend working with all these campaigns and getting out there way ahead of before you even hear the first ad on the radio or see that first little flyer come in your mailbox. How many people are involved up to that point who've gone to all the caucuses and conventions and worked through nominating and helping out all the way around? The hours that they put in and how it just kind of drags on a lot of them and wears on a lot of them.
Sure.
And by the time the season is is upon us, where now you got to get out and you've been marching in parades all summer, and now you got to get out and you got to start putting up signs and you got to do lit stuffing and then lit drops and on and on and on. These people are worn out and they're really tired. And all you hear is, oh, well, they didn't have a good enough message. A lot of times, a lot of the volunteers, when you don't have a big, huge pile of money sitting there coming in from unions, a lot of these people are doing this out of their own pocket,
yep.
And people don't understand how much money it takes to run an election and just put
money,
out a mail
time, sacrifice. Yeah. It takes a lot. It's not just money. It's a personal sacrifice. It's personal time. I mean, it engulfs your entire life.
Well, and it speaks to the, and thanks for the call, Dave. It speaks to the difficulty that so many of these candidates have, especially the newer candidates who don't have the name recognition. Case in point, article out of the Star Tribune talking about Tim Pawlenty offers Republicans formidable name in Minnesota governor's race, but big vulnerabilities too. So it says here in the article, recent election cycles have shown voters growing cynical of candidates with establishment ties and wary of paid advertising. Supporters of Pawlenty, who declined to be interviewed for the story, say that he'll bring the same set of political skills that made him the last Republican to win in a statewide race in Minnesota. The Pawlenty detractors, including a man who would most likely be his chief rival for the Republican nomination, said the former governor's time has passed and that he was out of touch with the Republican base and his fervent support of President Donald Trump. In the article, they talked to some voters here, and what really stuck out to me was it is a great example of that name recognition, the familiarity that people have. Because the moment you bring up Pawlenty's name, regardless of whether or not you have any opinions based off of his policies or what he'll do, you immediately have a reaction simply because you know who the individual is. And he immediately shoots to the top of the list for a number of different reasons. But first and foremost, it's because people know who he is because he's got that name recognition. And we've already seen that. I mean, we've had conversations with people talking about, you know, the caucus from last week and how, well, I held back. Why? Well, because I don't know if Mulaney's going to get in or not. Not even talking about what he's going to do. Not even talking about how he would serve. But just based off the fact that people know who he is, so he immediately has that ability to garner an opinion based off of that alone.
It's really interesting to hear the conversations and to talk to folks who are kind of sitting on the fence. And even then, it's like Pelini doesn't engender a ton of like genuine excitement, especially amongst, you know, the more conservative wing of the party. It's not like he governed as a staunch conservative or ran for a higher office as a staunch conservative. But you get that sense of, well, we just want to win. We just need a win.
Right.
And Pelini can win. You know, Pelini can raise enough money. Pelini can show up with enough money, and he's got enough name recognition. And you know, he's already won twice. And so I get the sense that a lot of people are in a position now where they are willing to sort of shrug their shoulders and go, well, you know, if that's the guy that can win, then that's probably the guy that we should go with.
Yeah, a lot of conceding going on.
Yeah.
In the article, even from Pelenti's potential supporters, they acknowledge that he would have to present a fresh vision for a third term. He says he's already been doing so quietly for more than a year. He's been speaking to chambers of commerce and community groups all over Minnesota. He's got video and computer doodads, according to the article, discussing how artificial intelligence is about to rapidly disrupt the American economy and the types of jobs that people work. Government has been able to adapt and exploit opportunities while mitigating the downsides for Minnesotans and jobs that are destined to be automated. Pelenti tells crowds who approach him afterwards for handshakes and selfies. The detractors, however, are saying they're happy to go and run against his record. We had a bridge collapse, higher tuition fees, property taxes, and he left a budget deficit behind, said state auditor Rebecca Otto. No surprise there. She finished second, as Drew said, in last week's DFL caucus straw poll to U.S. Representative Tim Walz.
And Jeff Johnson is quoted extensively in this article, and he makes some good points. I mean, the question is going to be, if Johnson goes on and gets the endorsement, which looks like there's a good chance of that happening at this point. Johnson goes ahead, gets the endorsement, and then there's a primary, Pelenti and Johnson. Pelenti is going to outspend him. How much will that endorsement matter in the primary? Who's going to show up in the primary election? Who's going to go out there and vote? Is it going to be people that value the endorsement and are going to vote for the endorsed candidate because he's the endorsed candidate? Or will Pelenti be able to outspend him and so, you know, as Johnson put it, parachute in and buy the primary?
651-989-5855. Coming up, we do have Voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen. He'll be joining us. Got some Vikings news to discuss with him now that the Super Bowl is over. We'll also talk about cash is pouring into the two Minnesota special elections. Two high-stakes special elections today. Both stand to test whether DFLers can capture the same political momentum, according to the Star Tribune, the Democrats have ridden to win recent elections in other states. And union clout, interesting piece also out of the Star Tribune. Union clout is one reason holding cops accountable is tough. Some rather interesting revelations in that article.
Justice